endless men whose age will be not to defend some ancient creed, but to live out the laws of Christ in every thought and word and deed. God send us men alert and quick, His lofty precepts to translate, until the laws of Christ become the laws and habits of the state.
Welcome to God Send Us Men Ministries with evangelist and missionary to America, Charlie Stewart. We challenge you to open your Bible and follow along with today's message. Prove all things, hold fast that which is good, study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. To contact us or read and listen to more teachings online for free, visit GodSendUsMen.com. And now, here is evangelist and missionary to America, Charlie Stewart.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for tuning into the message this morning. I want to remind you again now that we're just a week away from our gathering, and we're meeting from the 20th to the 23rd in Mount Vernon, Missouri at a campground that we have reserved. There's plenty of room, and we'd love for you to come and be a part of us for a few days of fellowship. If you are coming, please let us know as soon as you can. There's food details and things like that that we need to be prepared for, and there's details on the website at www.godsendusmen.com. I've got a lot to cover this morning, so I'm going to get right into the message. As you know, I've been preaching for more than 35 years now, almost 40 years, and I've been preaching that pretty much the entire world has completely missed the proper understanding of 1 Peter chapter 2. Now, I would expect some people to just immediately stand up and maybe even get angry at such a statement, because it certainly sounds like one man is saying, you know, I'm teaching the right way and everyone else in the world is teaching it wrong. And I can certainly see how my statement can come off as arrogant. I mean, I can see how without someone knowing me or how I came to that conclusion, that someone might just turn me off and say, you know, that guy just thinks he's a know-it-all, and then just tune out. I get that. But I need to remind you again, those of you that have known me for a long time, I mean, you get it, and that's great. For those of you who are new to me, okay, let me explain again. My mother, for most of my life, told me that I was physically born in what the world calls 1962. Now, that would, if my math is correct, make me almost a month more now than 61 years old. This past birthday, both my mom and my dad told me that I was only 60, not 61. So, with those two witnesses now seemingly correcting the record, okay, I'm going to have to go with 60. Now my wife refuses that and says that I have to stay with what I've been, or with what's been told to me for all the other years of my life, so I'm a bit conflicted right now. Anyway, my children think that I'm ancient, so, you know, what's a year, give or take, when you get to be this old? So I've been around for at least 60 years now. For my entire adult life, I have not been a participant with man's little g, quote, governments. I don't have their identifications. I don't claim their citizenship. I don't take any of their supposed, quote, benefits. I don't have or use a Social Security number. In fact, those of you who know me, you know that I've preached vehemently and lived, not just preached, against those things for my entire adult life. For more than 35 years now, I have lived as an exclusive citizen of the Commonwealth of Israel, so named in Ephesians chapter 2. Okay, well, ask me what happened to 5 years of my adult life. Okay, from 20 to 25 or 19 to 24, depending on who you believe about the date of physical entry into this world, I did not fully understand the implications of the Commonwealth of Israel. And I was a stateless man during that time. I was stateless. A very precarious place to be, but for the protection of God, until I realized that Israel was real. Israel is I-S-R-E-A-L. The day that fully sunk in on me was one of the happiest days of my life. God has a nation. And how in the world could I have read my Bible for over 20 years at that time and just then realized that God has a nation and all believers, all those who claim to be in Christ, are supposed to be exclusive citizens of that nation, grafted into Israel, grafted into the Commonwealth of Israel, is what the scriptures say. And almost every, quote, church man that I had ever known had actually thrown water on that idea and had worshiped the, quote, state in which they were born instead of the nation of God so clearly defined and named in Ephesians chapter 2. Anyway, at roughly 25 years old, give or take a year possibly, I left statelessness. I was not a member of any state, and publicly or earthly state, but publicly declared my citizenship to be exclusively in the Commonwealth of Israel. During my entire adult life, I've been reading the same Bible everyone else in the world has been reading. But because I had renounced all earthly citizenship and claimed only citizenship in the nation of God, the Commonwealth of Israel, and for anyone, not just me, but for anyone who has done the same thing, reading the exact same Bible, the exact same words on the pages, will bring about an understanding that many times, most times in fact, will have entirely different understandings from two people that are reading the exact same words, but from two different perspectives, and the understandings will be the exact opposite one from another. Now, simple. When two people read the exact same thing, and they come away with totally opposite understandings, this is the conclusion. Either they are both wrong, or one is right and one is wrong. It's really simple. I have never read, even when I was playing church, even when I was young, I have never read 1 Peter 2:13, not ever. Even when I was a stateless man in my teenage years and earlier playing church, I have never understood 1 Peter 2:13. Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme. I have never understood that to mean what nearly every other person in the world believes it to mean. And particularly that people are supposed to obey, quote, the government that they happened to be born around. The, quote, government that was in place around them when they were physically born into this world. I remember, I probably wasn't more than 16 years old, and I was arguing with someone who was saying that 1 Peter 2:13 was demanding unquestioned loyalty and obedience to anything that happened to claim to be a, quote, government. And I remember saying, trying to reason, okay, so you have, quote, Christians living in Germany in World War II, and you have, quote, Christians living in the U.S. in World War II, and the, quote, government of the U.S. told their Christian army men to go to Germany and kill the Germans whose, quote, government told their Christian army men to kill the U.S., quote, Christians. Christians killing Christians. And God is the one who commanded it to be so because, well, you know, 1 Peter 2:13. Well, that's ridiculous. Followers of Jesus Christ killing each other because one happened to be physically born in Germany and the other happened to be physically born in the U.S., but each were to be more faithful, more loyal to earthly, quote, governments than they were to the one that was supposed to be their supreme leader, Jesus Christ. Of course, that's what they have been taught in their, quote, churches now. You know, Jesus is king. Jesus is above all. No other name given under heaven among men. But then when their, quote, earthly government tells them to do something so repugnant, so clearly opposite of the teachings of the Word of God, so clearly opposite of the teachings of Christ. Well, you know, 1 Peter 2:13. In the, quote, Civil War in America, the, quote, Christians from the North, killing the, quote, Christians from the South, brothers killing brothers, uncles and nephews, maybe even dads against their own sons. Unbelievable how messed up that whole thing was. And why? Because nearly the entire world, even back then, does not understand what 1 Peter chapter 2 actually means. I've been preaching the exact opposite of the way the rest of the world has been teaching this for pretty much my entire life. I have a different perspective because I've not been a state citizen for my entire adult life. This is not arrogance. It's just stating simple facts. With that said, how many other preachers do you know that have lived the same way? We're reading the same Bible. We're reading the same words on the pages. But because of perspective, the conclusions are totally opposite one from another. The preacher who loves his U.S. flag, the preacher who loves the fact that he served in the military, the politician who swore an oath that the U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land with no other law having standing, their perspective of the exact same words in the Bible are going to be totally different from the preacher who says, flags of the world's nations are symbols of idolatry. It is a blatant violation of the laws of God to place men's laws and statutes above God's. It's totally wrong to swear allegiance to men's laws and statutes. In fact, it's wrong to swear at all. That's what Jesus said. That's what James said. Yet nearly every interaction between a citizen of the world and their, quote, government involves swearing an oath. Jesus said, but I say unto you, swear not at all. Yet every single day in this country, people who call themselves, quote, Christians, swear oaths like they were drinking a glass of water. But none of that matters because, well, 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter 2:13 somehow supersedes everything else in the Bible. God commanded, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man. And that total misrepresentation of what that actually means somehow nullifies every preceding word of God. Because it says every ordinance of man, which includes even those ordinances, quote unquote, that are repugnant to God's. After that statement, let me say this again. Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man does not mean what the churchmen have said it means. I don't care if I'm the only preacher in the world that speaks the opposite. I will say it again and again and again. They are 100% wrong if they are saying that means submit to ordinances that men create. That is not what that means. Ordinances are God's laws. They are not man's laws and statutes. Ordinances are God's and His alone, and they were created for men. They were created by God for men, and all men are to submit to His ordinances. They are, quote, ordinances of man because they are for all men. It doesn't mean that man created them. And then God is telling other men to obey other men's, quote, ordinances. Man does not, has not, has never been given permission from God to define good and evil, right and wrong. Men's, quote, laws and statutes are their definitions created out of their own hearts and their own minds to tell other people what they can and cannot do, what is right and what is wrong, what is legal and what is illegal. And God never gave men that authority over other men. Listen to me. The only authority that God gave one man over another is to hold each other accountable to the handful, the very few laws of God that He created as government for all men. No man is free to violate the laws of God. Thou shalt not commit murder. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness, and just a few other briefly comprehended laws. Friends, we must help the world come to the proper understanding of what 1 Peter chapter 2 means, because I'm telling you, we're in the shape that we're in today because the, quote, church and the churchmen have completely butchered this chapter, and the whole world is in deception because of this. The chapter is commanding all men to obey the laws of God. And pretty much the entire world believes that the chapter is God telling men to obey other men and obey their constitutions, their laws, their statutes, and no others are to have standing. I want you to listen closely to a very respected, quote, theologian. From all the way back in the 1800s, early 1800s in England, of course in England. And this is what he had to say regarding 1 Peter chapter 2. I'm telling you, this madness has been around for a long, long time, even before the 1800s. And it finds its origins in the despicable doctrine of the divine right of kings, which is still in effect. Because people do not understand that Jesus Christ fulfilled the prophets, all of them. They do not understand kings in the historical record of the Bible. And they do not understand that Jesus Christ was born to be king. That was his main purpose in being born. Now, listen to this. This is Charles John Ellicott on 1 Peter chapter 2, quote, Ellicott's commentary for English readers. To every ordinance of man, second prudential rule, subordination. Literally, to every human creation. For example, to every office or authority which men have established. Really? Literally, to every human creation, to every office or authority which men have established? Okay, when I first introduced Mr. Ellicott, I emphasized that he was from England. Okay, I want to remind you that when the 1611 KJV Bible came out, there's a letter which can be easily found online, and it's supposedly from the King of England to Richard Bancroft, who was named the Archbishop of Canterbury, and who was supposed to oversee the translation of the 1611 KJV Bible. Now, let me say this. I've never seen, not even a photocopy of this letter. And the original letter is supposedly in a library of the kings in England. But I've never seen the actual letter or a photocopy of it. But there are lots of people who have reproduced what they say is in the letter. Now, I wish I could see a copy of the original, but I can't find one. Maybe you can, but I've not been able to find one. I've looked for many hours. But in that letter, supposedly the King of England told the Archbishop of Canterbury that the translators were not to include the margin notes of the Geneva Bible. And of course, the margin notes of the Geneva Bible went against the despicable divine right of kings doctrine that the kings of England ruled by. And specifically, as I've shown you in the past, the notes on 1 Peter chapter 2. Every ordinance of man is not meant to be understood that ordinances were invented by men. They were not. Ordinances were invented by God, and they were made for men, for all men to obey. Ordinances are not the inventions of men. They are the inventions of God, and they are for men for them to obey. The influence on the KJV Bible by the King of England and his despicable claim to the divine right of kings, it just simply cannot be overlooked. For instance, you're probably not aware of this little known nugget. Do you know that pretty much every single English translation prior to the KJV had the word tyrant in it? Listen to this. This is real, very interesting. Quote, and then this is a different quote now. We're going to be getting back to Ellicott here in just a minute. This is a different quote. Many people may be unaware of the fact that the earlier English Bibles sometimes had the word tyrant or the word tyranny in the text. At Isaiah 13:11, the 1599 Geneva Bible reads, "I will cause the arrogancy of the proud to cease and will cast down the pride of tyrants." The Geneva Bible at Job 6:23, "And deliver me from the enemy's hand, or ransom me out of the hand of tyrants." Again, at Isaiah 49:25, it noted, "The prey of the tyrant shall be delivered." At Job 27:13, the Geneva Bible reads, "This is the portion of a wicked man with God, and the heritage of tyrants, which they shall receive of the Almighty." Its rendering at the beginning of Job 3:17 stated, "The wicked have ceased from their tyranny." The Geneva Bible also has the word tyrant or tyrants in other verses, such as Job 15:20 and Psalm 54:3. The 1535 Coverdale's Bible and the 1540 edition of the Great Bible also use these same renderings in several verses. The Bishop's Bible has tyrants at Job 6:23, Job 15:20, Job 27:13, and Psalm 15:3, and tyrant at Isaiah 13:11 and 16:4. At 1 Timothy 1:13, Tyndale, Coverdale, Matthew, the Great Bible all had the word tyrant. At James 2:6, Whittingham's, the Geneva, Bishop's Bibles had "oppress you by tyranny," while the Great Bible has "execute tyranny upon you." Concerning Genesis 10:8-9, Ovid Need wrote, "Both the text wording and the notes of the Geneva speak harshly against oppressors and tyrants, such as we have today. As I have used the Geneva and compared it with the KJV, I understand why King James wanted to rid Christians of the Geneva Bible." Listen very closely to this. This is very interesting. Changing a word from "the" to "a" can change the entire meaning. Listen, it continues. An example is found in Matthew 2:6. The KJV says "a governor," where the Geneva says "the governor," in reference to Jesus Christ. The strong wording that demands that only one sovereign, Jehovah God, in the form of Jesus Christ, was removed from the KJV. It is interesting that those bishops that heard King James complain about the margin notes in the Geneva Bible didn't mention that the Bishop's Bible had similar marginal notes. The Bishop's Bible had some marginal notes that condemned tyrants or tyranny. The marginal note at Exodus 1:15 in the 1595 edition of the Bishop's was the following: "Tyrants tried diverse ways to oppress the," and the word there is "church." They didn't get it all right. At Exodus 1:17, the bishop's note stated, "It was better to obey God than man." Is it possible that King James I did not want believers to read how strongly God's word condemns tyranny and tyrants? Did King James think that some might regard some of his actions as being those of a tyrant? Alexander McClure referred to King James as the tyrant. The KJV translators, page 50. Why do the KJV translators remove the words tyrant, tyrants, and tyranny from the text of the English Bible? According to the first rule given to the translators, what, quote, truth of the original demanded this change? Is it possible that the KJV translators agreed with the view of civil government held by King James? Did the translators avoid using the word tyrant to keep from offending King James, or were they perhaps instructed to remove it? What was wrong with the use of the word tyrant in the English Bibles? William Pierce asserted, "Tyrannical rulers have ever found support from prelates." Historical Introduction, page 36. Samuel Rutherford maintained that tyranny, being a work of Satan, is not from God. Edwin Bissell commented, "Whatever else James I might tolerate, he would not allow any weakening of the doctrine of the supremacy of kings." And no other version of the English Bible betrayed such definite leanings that tenet toward that tenant as the one made under his own direction. The 1611 KJV's contents chapter heading at Ecclesiastes 10 for verse 20 is, men's thoughts of kings ought to be revered. That comment was still found in a KJV edition printed at Cambridge in 1769, although it has one spelling change of reverend to reverent. The same form of this comment as found in the 1769 Cambridge was still found in editions of the KJV printed at Cambridge in 1872 and 1887 and at Oxford in 1868, 76, and 85. In the dedication to King James in the 1611, Thomas Bilson referred to him as, quote, the most high and mighty prince. Jonathan Stonis asserted, we completely and fully reject the blasphemy of referring to King James as the most high. Stonis asked, can you imagine the public outcry if a modern version had such a dedication? End quote. So of course, and let me say this before I go on. So all those prior English Bibles had the word tyrant and tyranny in it. Well, guess what? The King James Bible of 1611 does not have the word tyrant or tyranny in it. So, of course, getting back to Ellicott, the Englishman's notes on 1 Peter 2:13, he was an English, quote, theologian. He was a professor at the King's College. This is something that we should expect with someone from those credentials or with those credentials. And go back. We're going back to his commentary now. Remember, this is how he started it. To every ordinance of man, the second prudential rule, subordination, literally, to every human creation, to every office or authority which men have established. It is not only to ordinances of directly divine institution that we're to submit. Mind that he does not say we're to submit to every law that men may pass. This passage is most directly modeled on Romans 13:1, where the reason assigned for submission is the same as that in John 19:11, that ultimately the authority proceeds from God himself. Here, however, the thought is quite different. They are to submit, but not because of the original source from which the authority flows, but because of the practical consequences of not submitting. It must be done, quote, for the Lord's, Jesus Christ's sake, in order not to bring discredit upon his teaching and persecution upon his church. This difference of treatment in the midst of so much resemblance shows that at the date of St. Peter's letter, there was much more immediate cause for laying stress on political subordination. St. Paul, writing to the Roman church, urges submission to Claudius because the Roman Jews, among whom the Christians were reckoned, were often in trouble and expelled from the city of Rome, Acts 18:2. St. Peter, writing in all probability from the Roman church, urges submission to Nero and the provincial governors because, quote, ignorant and foolish men were beginning to misrepresent the Christian church as a kind of internationalist or socialist conspiracy. The king as supreme. First division of second prudential rule, subordination political. Of course it means the emperor. The name king, though detested in Latin, was used without scruple by the provincial Greeks to express the sovereignty of the Caesars. When he is described here as supreme, it is not intended, as our English version would convey, to contrast his supreme power with the inferior power of the governors. The word is only the same which is rendered higher in Romans 13:1. Huther rightly says, the emperor was in the Roman Empire not merely the highest, but actually the only ruler. All other magistrates were but the instruments by which he exercised his sway. Of course, all Asia Minor, to which St. Peter was writing, was in the Roman Empire. The language would have been different had the letter been addressed to, or perhaps had it ever even been written from, the geographical Babylon. All right, now let's stop here for just a minute. Ellicott has introduced his opinions, his ideas concerning what God intends for people to understand about, quote, kings and their relation to them. This is it. This is the despicable doctrine of the divine right of kings, which the country of England has been so famous for. Listen again. That ultimately, the authority proceeds from God himself. End quote. He's saying that the authority of God is shown to the world through men's little g, quote, governments, obeying men. Even Claudius, even Nero is obeying God. Now, this is his reasoning, his ideas, his thoughts, but they are not based on the will of God, which was shown in the first 39 books of our Bibles. Turn to Exodus chapter 1. What Ellicott is trying to make people believe is not based on the foundation of what God established long before 1 Peter chapter 2 was written. We've got to see the foundations of the last 27 books in the first 39. If we don't, if we seek what looks like contradiction, then we need to understand why, and we need to see the Bible as a book without contradiction. We need to see harmony in our Bibles from cover to cover, and when we don't, when we see people teaching disharmony, it must be exposed. Exodus chapter 1, verse 1, the will of God concerning how to interact with kings in the Old Covenant. Now, these are the names of the children of Israel which came into Egypt. Every man in his household came with Jacob. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, for sake of time, skip to verse 5, and all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, for Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. And the children of Israel were fruitful, and increased abundantly, and multiplied, and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And he said to his people, behold, the people, the children of Israel, are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Therefore they did set over them taskmasters to afflict with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they were afflicted, the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were grieved because of the children of Israel. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service when they made them serve was with rigor. And the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of one of them was Shiphrah and the name of the other Puah. Now here it comes. One of the earlier examples of misunderstanding every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme. And remember, Ellicott said even to obey Claudius and Nero. Well, the pharaohs of Egypt were nothing compared to Claudius and Nero. This is a king. This was the king of Egypt. And we're going to see some of the faithful children of Israel and how they responded to the king and his, quote, every ordinance of man. And he said, the king said, when you do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then ye shall kill him. But if it be a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. I'm telling you this morning, I first heard of or read this story probably around the age of 6 or 7. I remember, even at that early age, I was the little kid sitting on the front row at, quote, church, glued to every word that the preacher was saying. All I wanted to be in life was a preacher. I didn't want to be a doctor. I didn't want to be a fireman. I didn't want to be anything other than a preacher. I thought being a preacher was the greatest thing anyone could do, even at that very young age. So when I first heard or read this passage, I remember, and the thing that stuck out most to me, the principle that hit me like a ton of bricks and burned into my being even as a child. And friends, I don't have an explanation for that. I mean, most of the other kids were asleep in their mother's lap at, quote, church. But when the preaching was going on, man, I was wide awake, glued to every word of that Bible that was said. And all I remember from Exodus 1:17 was, "And they did not as the king of Egypt commanded them." The midwives feared God and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them. And man, that's Exodus chapter 1. That's the second book of our Bible. This is what we learn long before we get to 1 Peter chapter 2. This is the second book. 1 Peter is almost at the end. Don't tell me the principle that they feared God and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them was somehow dismantled, replaced with all of a sudden obey every whim of Nero. And not only that, but do it for the Lord's sake. But the midwives feared God and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them. When that's burned into your heart and your understanding, and that becomes a guiding principle as you progress through the rest of the Bible, when you get to 1 Peter chapter 2 and you read that and you understand that what you're reading there must agree with what God has already established, then all of a sudden it isn't all that difficult. But when your approach to the scriptures is that what you read in Genesis and Exodus is just bedtime stories for the children that don't have any application for today, then you can read 1 Peter chapter 2 and jerk it out, lay it on the table, and tell people that God commanded his own people to obey the Caesars who history records. Listen to this. Quote, "The phrase Son of God is applied in the Roman Empire to Augustus. The main theme that the article addresses is how a Roman citizen living in the Roman Empire interpret Augustus being called the Son of God. Julius Caesar, Augustus' adopted father, was viewed as divine and holy during his lifetime. The inscription to Julius Caesar in Macedonia states, "To the Emperor Caesar, God, Son of God, Augustus." He had been declared a god of the Roman state, Divus Julius. If Julius Caesar was declared to be divine, to be the divine god by the Roman state, the logic would follow that his son would also be divine. However, it would seem that Augustus in his divine state began when he was a young boy before his adoption by Caesar. It was believed by the Romans that Augustus was the son of Apollo himself. Therefore, Augustus was a son of God by Caesar's adoption of him and divine begetting through being the son of Apollo. Augustus only received the title of godship through his adoption by Caesar. Augustus being the adopted son of Caesar posed a problem in ancient antiquity. In the Greco-Roman world, adopted sons were viewed as being lesser to natural-born sons. This caused great tension across the Roman Empire because between adopted and natural-born sons, end quote. Yet compare that with other words from the book of Exodus. Turn to Exodus chapter 20. Ellicott says that God himself commanded Christians to obey the Caesars who called themselves gods. Claudius and Nero and the rest of them just goes without saying. History, if you can believe any of it, says the Caesars call themselves gods. And here the Christian, not Christian friends, it's churchian. Ellicott says that the writer of 1 Peter chapter 2 is demanding obedience to the Caesars. Exodus 20 verse 1. "And God spake all these words saying, I am the Lord thy God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Friends, this is the second of 66 books that make up our Bibles. This is the foundation. And we're expected to believe that this is what the God of the Bible at one time demanded. But then he sent his son to change this. God sent Jesus to earth to tell people that Exodus 20 is no longer valid. This is why the world is in the shape it's in. The purposeful twisting of 1 Peter chapter 2 into something it cannot say. 1 Peter chapter 2 cannot be an instruction for men and women, boys and girls to serve the Caesars. If it is, if that's what it really means, then friends, count me out. I do not serve a schizophrenic God. I do not serve a God that instructed some men at some point in history to conclude, fear God and keep his commandments is the whole duty of men, and then years later change his mind and say that that was only for a certain time. Now, I know what some people might want to say, but what about the sacrifices? What about the, quote, baptisms? Those are no longer commanded, okay, but that's not accurate. The sacrifices, the immersions, okay, they're still commanded. But what we saw of those sacrifices and those washings in the first 39 books, the Bible tells us they were but types and shadows of the sacrifices and the washings that were made perfect in the new world. God didn't say stop the sacrifices. God didn't say stop the washings. He just said there was a better way to sacrifice and a better way to wash. And the book is quite clear on these issues. The central theme of the Bible, one of the first examples, Exodus chapter 1, fear God, keep his commandments, has never changed and will never change. What we call the first commandment, thou shalt have no other gods before me, has never changed and will never change. Go back to, and let's finish, the last several verses of Exodus chapter 1, beginning in verse 18. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and have saved the men children alive? And the midwives said unto Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as Egyptian women, for they're lively and are delivered ere the midwives come in unto them. Okay, there's a principle there. When a usurper demands why we obeyed God and not them, okay, there's more than one answer that can be given, and it's pleasing to God. Let me just leave it at that. That's for another time. Verse 20, therefore, God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed very mighty. And it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. That historical record that God has caused to be memorialized forever should be burned into the heart, soul, and mind of every man, woman, boy, and girl that claims to be a follower of Jesus Christ. If that principle was burned into everyone's hearts and minds as they continue through the Word of God, by the time they reach the last 27 books, it should easily be seen how to harmonize the Word from cover to cover. I'm telling you that even when I was briefly playing, quote, church, and quote, church man, never, not one time ever did I teach another man that Jesus told his people to render unto Caesar, as if Jesus was telling them to obey the Caesars. Not one time ever did I teach another man, woman, boy, or girl that 1 Peter chapter 2 meant, quote, obey all the laws of the land. I'd heard that said 1,000 times before, but I never taught it that way. I never taught it the way it was in the, quote, church, because it's not Bible. It's not the way of God, and the record must be corrected. Listen now as I continue with Ellicott's notes on 1 Peter chapter 2. Quote, pulpit commentary, verse 13, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man. The aorist passive is used as often as in middle sense. Now listen to this. Here comes the double-mindedness of the, quote, church man. The word for ordinance is ketitsis, which in classical Greek means foundation, as of city. But in the New Testament is used elsewhere only of the works of God, in the sense of creation or a creature. See Mark 16:15, Colossians 1:23. Exactly. Ordinance is used in the New Testament as only of the works of God. It is not the works of men. It is not invented by men. Ordinances are exclusively the creation of God. God is the only one who created ordinances. Man is not allowed. Man does not have the ability to define what is right and what is wrong. God and God alone has kept that to himself. He's the only one capable of being the original designer of right and wrong, good and evil, lawful and unlawful. After so accurately providing the definition of ordinance, listen to what he says next. Ellicott continues, quote, "Hence some, as DeWitt, translate the words to every human creature, supporting their view by 1 Peter 5:5. But on the whole, this seems unlikely, is a strange and awkward periphrasis. It is better to understand as a meaning, or I'm sorry, it is better to understand it as meaning a human creation or foundation," end quote. Now he's saying the exact opposite of what he said was supposed to be meant by ordinance. He just said ordinances is used in other New Testament passages exclusively as the works of God. And now he's saying it means a human creation or a human foundation. How in the world people did not see through this is just amazing. He goes on, right, left, right, left. Certainly, there is no power but of God, Romans 13:1. Yeah, that's exactly what Romans 13 says, as plainly and clearly as anything can be. There is no power but of God. God has kept it all to himself. Okay, that's right. Now, back to the left. But the form which that power assumes is a human institution. St. Peter bids his readers to submit themselves to the de facto form of government for the Lord's sake, not from human motives as fear of punishment, but for the Lord's sake, because the powers that be are ordained of God, and in obeying them we obey the ordinance of God, end quote. This is the despicable divine right of kings. When you obey the Caesars, when you obey earthly, quote, kings, you are obeying God. Well, why then wasn't that the way it was in Exodus chapter 1 with the midwives? Why wasn't it that way with Daniel in Babylon? Why wasn't it that way with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Why wasn't it that way with the prophets? Why wasn't it that way with Mordecai, with Moses, with Samuel? Okay, somehow we've got a new God in the new covenant world. Ellicott continues, back to the right before turning back to the left. Christians were commonly accused of insubordination, of doing, quote, contrary to the decrees of Caesar, Acts 17:7, end quote. Yes, they were, because true Christians have their faith, their belief based on the foundational principles from the first 39 books of the Bible. That's where we find the will of God. That's where we find the mind of God. And now Ellicott, back to the left. They must show by their conduct that these accusations are false, that the progress of the gospel be not hindered, whether it be to the king as supreme. By, quote, the king is meant the Roman emperor, who was frequently so described in the Greek writers. Nero was emperor when St. Peter wrote. Christians were to obey even him, wicked tyrant as he was, for his power was given him from above, as the Lord himself has said of Pilate, John 19:11. And of course, when your state Bible is one that has the word tyrant and tyranny removed, I get it. Okay, here again. Yes, but understanding the Bible as a whole, not just from twisting one verse in an attempt to unravel the whole rest of the Bible. We know in the Old Covenant world, yes, God raised up kings and brought them down. That's what happened from the time the Israelites said, "Give us a king like all the other nations." But even still, even under that system and that punishment for their rebellion, God still expected people to obey him and not the kings when the kings did wrong, which was most of the time. Exodus chapter 1 is a very good example. And now more doublespeak and biblical errors from Ellicott. As of John 19:11, where Ellicott said Christians were to obey him, technically speaking, I realize that doesn't matter to most, but it does matter concerning truth. But the word Christian did not even come around until well after John 19. Now, let's change gears for just a minute. We have just read Charles Ellicott's commentary on 1 Peter chapter 2, where he explicitly says that Christians were to obey the Caesars. The Caesars were the, quote, powers that be from Romans 13, and Christians are to submit to everything the Caesars decree, because to obey the Caesars was to obey God. Now, if we can believe the history books, Nero, who Ellicott specifically named in his commentary, was the emperor in Rome when the book of 1 Peter was written. All right. Now, we've already seen in Exodus chapter 1 where the midwives refused to obey the king, and God blessed them for it and even set them up as one of the greatest historical records we have in our Bibles. But the skeptic might say, how ridiculous. The king commanded them to kill babies, but they refused. No one would think that murdering babies was to be obeyed. If a king commands someone to murder someone, you should not obey. But that's not what we're told by the twisted teaching of submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake. It's funny how in the quote church world, that word every can take on all sorts of meanings, kind of like the word all in Matthew 24 concerning all things be fulfilled. But no one would ever think that a king, certainly not in modern times, would demand that babies be murdered. And listen to this. This is from NPR, what they call February 1, 2016 headline. How China's one-child policy led to forced abortions, 30 million bachelors. Last October, China ended its 35-year-old policy of restricting most urban families to one child. Commonly referred to as the one-child policy, the restrictions were actually a collection of rules that governed how many children married couples could have. The basic idea was to encourage everybody, by coercion if necessary, to keep to one child, journalist Mei Fong tells Fresh Air's Terry Gross. Fong explores the wide-ranging impact of what she calls the world's most radical experiment in her book, in her new book, One Child. She says that among the policy's unintended consequences is an acute gender imbalance. When you create a system where you would shrink the size of a family and people who would have to choose, then people would choose sons, Fong says. Now China has 30 million more men than women, 30 million bachelors who cannot find brides. They call them guang guan, broken branches, that's the name in Chinese. They're the biological dead ends of their family. Fong says the policy also led to forced abortions and the confiscation of children by the authorities. Looking ahead, China is also facing a fierce shortage of workers who can support its aging population, end quote. Of course, you know, things like that never happen in modern times. Okay, so my reading of Exodus chapter 1 this morning and equating that principle to our lives today, well, that was just silly, right? You know, but Ellicott has 1 Peter chapter 2 in the time of Nero. And he's saying that God himself demanded Christians to obey Nero. All right, open your Bibles to Revelation chapter 13, please. And let's read just a little beginning in verse 1. Most of you that are listening to me are going to understand this. I want to appeal right now to preterists who should understand this, who would agree with Ellicott's interpretation of 1 Peter chapter 2 in obeying the Caesars. Okay, verse 1. And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth is the mouth of lion. Go back to verse 1, the name of blasphemy. Remember what we read about the Caesars calling themselves God, calling themselves the Son of God. Okay, verse 3 now. or the end of verse 2, and the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as it were wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. And they worshipped the dragon which gave power unto the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth. And he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. And he exerciseth all power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them that which dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image of the beast, which had the wound by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak, and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell, save he had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Here is wisdom, let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Now, we aren't seeing a king of men here demanding the murder of babies. We see a king of the earth demanding that everyone in his realm receive a mark in their right hand or in their forehead. This is a command. It's a law. It's a, quote, ordinance in the most vulgar sense of the word by an earthly king, Nero, who Ellicott said Christians were to obey, that he was requiring of those under his rule. What's the big deal? This isn't killing babies. Okay, this should be as seen as obeying the Caesars, doing what the, quote, government tells you to. Obey every ordinance that man comes up with, and do it because God demands it. This is from Chuck Swindoll, one of the most influential, quote, churchmen in our generation. And he wrote this about the book of 1 Peter, quote, Who wrote the book? The first word of this epistle, Peter identifies the author who called himself an apostle of Jesus Christ, 1 Peter 1:1. He wrote this letter to a group of Christians scattered throughout the northern areas of Asia Minor, where he may have previously preached the gospel. Peter wrote to a group of people that probably included both Jews and Gentiles. The apostle addressed the letter's recipients as, quote, aliens, 1:1, a word indicating that Peter was speaking not just to Jews or just to Gentiles, but to Christians who were living their lives in such a way that they would have stood out as aliens among the certain surrounding culture. Where are we? In this letter, Peter spoke about persecution, which anticipated the persecution he and other Christians would endure in the final years of Nero's reign. At the time he wrote, Peter had not yet been arrested, an event that would lead to his martyrdom around 66 AD to 68 AD. Stop here for just a minute. It's what's so confusing about what these guys are selling. Why would someone like Peter ever have gotten arrested? If Peter's message was obey the Caesars no matter what they do, no matter what, quote, ordinance they create, obey the Caesars, why would he ever have gotten arrested? That makes no sense at all. We see the exact same thing today. The, quote, churchmen have been saying forever, obey men's governments. Okay, they aren't arrested. They aren't persecuted. They're some of the most protected class of people in all of society. Their, quote, churches have tax-exempt status. They aren't persecuted. They are protected. If Peter and Paul and those guys were telling all their followers that God said to obey the Caesars would have done nothing but encourage that message. That is ridiculous to try to peddle this nonsense. Back to Swindoll. 1 Peter 5:13 indicates that Peter sent greetings from the local church, calling it, quote, Babylon, but it's most likely that the apostle was writing in a common metaphor there. He used the name of the ancient Mesopotamian city as a stand-in for Rome, the modern city that, like Babylon, gave itself over to idol worship and false gods. While the fact is not recorded in the Bible, Peter has long been thought to have spent his final years serving the church in Rome. Based on the numerous references to suffering and persecution in this letter, Peter likely wrote in AD 64, just as the persecution of Christians under Nero was ramping up. Why is 1 Peter so important? 1 Peter focuses on the importance of believers bearing up under unjust suffering yet continuing to live well, 1 Peter 2:20. In this way, 1 Peter might be called the Job of the New Testament, providing encouragement for the true believer to continue on in the way Jesus had laid out for all his followers. The endurance Peter called these believers to is similar to Job's, a man who suffered despite his righteousness. Peter maintained that this was the kind of true perseverance that God expects from his people. What's the big idea? Living in close proximity to Jesus Christ for more than 3 years had provided the Apostle Peter the best possible example of what it looked like to live in holiness amid a hostile world. More than any other man who walked the earth, Jesus modeled that lifestyle. Peter therefore pointed his readers in the best possible direction to Jesus himself. The apostle called Christians to sanctify Christ as Lord in their hearts, that believers might live and act as Jesus desires during their short time here on earth. First Peter 3:14-18. This would include submission to authority, even unjust authority. Of course, when your Bible has tyrant and tyrants and tyranny removed from it, in the government, in the home, and in the workplace. Jesus becomes the focal point for ordering one's life in the midst of trials and tribulations. By rooting their perseverance in the person and work of Christ, believers can always cling to hope in the midst of suffering. End quote. The historians tell us that Nero died in 68 AD. Though the Bible does not specifically state that Nero was the beast, the dragon of Revelation 13, it's easy to see that this is who this is talking about. All these guys that say that 1 Peter 2 is talking about obeying the Caesars, okay, even the ESV, quote, Bible uses the word emperor in 1 Peter 2:13. What do they do with Revelation chapter 13? All right, turn to Revelation 20. Begin with verse 1. And I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years, and cast him in the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal upon him that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years should be fulfilled. And after that, he must be loosed a little season. And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them. And I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received his mark upon their foreheads or in their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. Because these, quote, church men do not understand that all the prophecies were fulfilled in the first century, they cannot understand 1 Peter chapter 2. During the same time that Peter was supposedly telling the Christians to obey the Caesars were demanding that the Christians receive the Caesar's mark in their hands or in their foreheads. And the record is clear. The Christians did not take the mark. Neither did they worship the Caesars. Neither did they worship the Caesar's image. Neither did they serve that, quote, king. The events recorded in the book of Revelation were going on at the same time or shortly thereafter that the book of 1 Peter was written. And these guys are saying that the Christians were persecuted and killed from 64 to 68 AD. But the supposed message of the Christians was to obey the Caesars It absolutely makes no sense at all. Men's little g governments do not persecute their faithful. They do not persecute those that are obedient to them. I've said this for 40 years now. The quote, church and the churchmen live in a fantasy world. They've got their own language. Some of them have got their own created language that no one can even understand. They live in a weird world that's outside of reality. And it's mostly contained inside their four walls, but it's a world that's not based in reality. Their false, destructive teachings on 1 Peter chapter 2 is what the ungodly in the world have used to gain unbridled power that they have over mankind today. We must stand firm on the Bible truth that 1 Peter chapter 2 is commanding exclusive obedience to God and to His ordinances. Strike that. We must stand firm on the Bible truth that 1 Peter chapter 2 is commanding exclusive obedience to God and to ordinances. It was superlative to say His ordinances. There are no ordinances that are not His ordinance. An ordinance is God's and God's alone. Man is not allowed to make up their own definitions of right and wrong, good and evil, lawful and unlawful.
You've been listening to God Send Us Men Ministries with evangelist and missionary to America, Charlie Stewart. To contact us or to read and listen to more teachings online for free, visit GodSendUsMen.com.